Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Genesis chapter 19. I'm going to cover verses 23 through 38. I'm going to entitle this section of Scripture, God Destroys Sodom. Our context is this. In the first part of chapter 19, the first 22 verses, we had God rescuing Lot from Sodom. And Lot is on the run. He left that morning before the disaster fell on Sodom. And so we begin now in Genesis 19, verses 23 through 25. The sun had risen over the earth when Lot came to Zoar. In other words, dawn had come, Lot had fled, and he came to Zoar. Zoar was one of the five cities of the plain right south of the Dead Sea near the brook Zered, as the brook Zered runs into the Dead Sea. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven, and he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. Now, John Gill makes the interesting point that the sun rose just like every other day in Sodom, and everybody thought in Sodom probably thought it was going to be a fine day just like any other, and then all of a sudden, bam, disaster strikes. A biblical plague, an apocalyptic event. Now, the raining of brimstone and fire from God out of heaven, I remember as a child, I remember thinking, well, how can just brimstone and fire fall out of the sky? Well, that was a little naive way of looking at it. John Gill actually interprets it this way. He says this is a supernatural sulfur and fire falling down out of heaven. Gill says the destruction was so extraordinary it couldn't be from natural causes. Well, I think Gill is entirely wrong there. The NIV Study Bible and Wikipedia, for what that's worth, say that the destruction of Sodom could very well have come from natural causes. Why? Because there's a large fault running down the east side of the Salt Sea, the Dead Sea, which of course is at the southern end of that fault is where the five cities of the plain were, including Sodom and Gomorrah. So here are two options as to what might have happened to Sodom. Here's option one. There are still today, even, asphalt deposits under the ground all over the area. Because of that fault, you could have sliding tectonic plates that could have slid over each other and put weight and heat on that asphalt, igniting the asphalt. And then as the tectonic plates kept shifting, the ignited asphalt would have been thrust upward through that fault line right into the air, and then the burning asphalt would fill the air and come raining down on the city. And to me, that makes perfectly good sense. Now, here's option number two, which is a little bit more complicated. The fault there on the eastern side of the Dead Sea could have produced an earthquake of Richter scale 6. Sodom was built close to the edge of the Salt Sea because Sodom traded in asphalt, probably. There was lots of water in the rock in that area that's close to the Salt Sea. The earthquake would push the water up into the soil. The soil would then liquefy. The soil would have become infirm, and the resulting landslide would have thrown Sodom into the Dead Sea. Well, that's nice, but I don't know how that explains the phrase here in Genesis 19:24, then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire. I don't know how this theory takes care of that. It could be a combination of the two theories. Fire and brimstone coming from the air as Sodom slides into the Salt Sea. I tend to think it's both option one and option two together. Option two was confirmed by an interesting experiment by a professor from Hull University and from a guy from the British Museum. Let me just read this. Another guy from Cambridge University. This is from a web page article that I found. Quote, could science prove that Harris is a retired geologist who came up with this landslide theory. Could science prove that Harris's scenario might have happened? Professor Lynn Frostick, a geologist from Hull University in England, and Jonathan Tubb from the British Museum decided to investigate just that. They traveled to the Middle East to pursue their research, and their findings there enabled Dr. Gopal Matabushi at the Cambridge University Centrifuge Laboratory back in England to build an accurate scaled-down model of the buildings in Sodom and the ground on which they stood. Dr. Matabushi then subjected the model to a simulated earthquake, and his data provided the ultimate proof on whether whole towns could have been destroyed. Dr. Gopal Matabushi and his team built structures in ground that exactly replicated conditions in the Dead Sea in the early Bronze Age. They then put this model in the centrifuge to spin it, creating 50 times the force of gravity on the model. This made the model act in exactly the same way as if it were full size. The Cambridge team then fired an earthquake of strength 6 The results showed precisely what full-size buildings would have done after an earthquake of this magnitude. The experiment pointed to a scene of utter calamity. The results picked up by sensors in the model were remarkable. The experiment pointed to a scene of utter calamity. The ground would have turned to quicksand with the houses sliding as far as they could until they reached the bottom of the Dead Sea. The Cambridge experiment vindicated Harris, showing his scenario could have happened. Sodom and Gomorrah could have been towns built on the edge of the Dead Sea and could have been destroyed by earthquake and landslide. Well, that's nice, but they still got to have sulfur coming from the air, and I think that came from the burning asphalt being pushed up through that fault. Now, verse 24 mentions Sodom and Gomorrah being destroyed by brimstone and fire from heaven. Also, Adma and Zeboim were destroyed. Also, we read that later on in Deuteronomy 29, verse 23. All its land is brimstone and salt, a burning waste, unsown and unproductive, and no grass grows in it. Like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, Adma and Zeboim, which the Lord overthrew in his anger and in his wrath. God does get angry every now and then, folks. I know that no American Christian likes to admit that too much. Too busy reading Rob Bell. Adma and Zeboim, of course, Zoar survived. Of the five cities of the plain, only Zoar survived. That's the city that Lot escaped to, or was told to escape to. He changed his mind, didn't go there, as we'll see in a minute. Now, that brimstone and fire that the New American Standard says came out of heaven, the NIV says burning sulfur. Brimstone is sulfur. John Gill says that this brimstone and fire or this burning sulfur is consistent with asphalt burning. Adam Clark says this, quote, the bitumen, which is another fancy name for asphalt, the bitumen is in all probability accompanied from the bottom with sulfur, as both of them are found promiscuously upon the shore. So earthquakes throw up sulfur, and in this case, the asphalt all down there by the Dead Sea, and so fire and brimstone. The fire coming from the asphalt that's burning, caught on fire by the heat. John Gill puts it less scientifically and more poetically, hell came down from heaven. That's a great way to describe it. One of these days that might be happening to the United States of Sodom and Gomorrah, who knows? Jude 1:7 says this, just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, that would be Adma and Zeboim, since they in the same way as these indulged in gross immorality and went after strange flesh, that means they were homosexuals, are exhibited as an example in undergoing the punishment of eternal fire. You know, this idea of saying, well, you know, homosexuality is not a big deal. Well, it is a big deal. Here, Jude says that not only would the citizens of the plain down there in Sodom and Gomorrah suffer physical destruction from earthly fire, they're going to suffer eternal destruction, spiritual destruction, eternal fire in hell. If someone loves homosexuals, I remember I had a homosexual roommate. He was bisexual at the time. He ended up dying from AIDS. He was a good friend of mine. And if he had been warned against this homosexuality of his, he might, and I didn't know it actually at the time. I didn't find out till later that he was a homosexual. He didn't come out till later. But if he had been warned against the penalties of homosexuality, he might be alive today. He might be going to my high school reunions, and I might be seeing him there and reminiscing on the good times that we had at the University of South Carolina. But oh no, he's got to go chase homosexuality and destroy his life. Well, if you love homosexuals, folks, you won't pussyfoot around and talk about how, well, it's just a choice. You were made that way, which there's never been any evidence proving that homosexuals were made that way. They chose to be that way. And Sodom is a good example of what happened to a city of homosexuals. Genesis 19, verse 26, but his, that's Lot's, wife from behind him looked back and she became a pillar of salt. This is a famous scene in the Old Testament because of Lot's wife. She's famous. People still remember her as a pillar of salt. Now, she's traveling from behind Lot, so Lot, unless he turned around every 2 minutes, Lot really couldn't see what his wife was doing, and that would probably increase the temptation of Lot's wife to look back at Sodom as they escaped. Now, here's some options as to why she looked back. She wanted to see the destruction of her father's house and family. I mean, that's big. I would have wanted to look, too. She might have wanted to see whether her married daughters were following her. All these are John Gill suggestions. Gill also says another reason she might have looked back is that she was longing for her material goods that she had left behind. That could be. Could be she grieved for the people of Sodom. She might have had some friends down there getting toasted. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggests, well, maybe she's just curious. I'm a very curious person. I'd want to look. But the looking was disobedience of a direct command from an angel, Genesis 19:17, in our previous audio, when they had brought them outside, one said, when the two angels had brought Lot and his wife and two daughters outside, one of the angels said, escape for your life, do not look behind you. But she looked behind. She disobeyed the angel and she died. Now, she became a pillar of salt, and this is what's interesting. Adam Clark says this, quote, the vast variety of opinions, both ancient and modern, on the crime of Lot's wife, her change, and the manner in which that change was effected, are in many cases as unsatisfactory as they are ridiculous. Well, let's look at some non-ridiculous options. First of all, options as to how her death may have happened. And then we'll look at some options as to how she was turned into a pillar of salt. First of all, and we think about the pillar of salt so much we forget, she died on the spot, which is unusual. Here's some options as to how. John Gill says the immediate hand of God. God just killed her because she disobeyed the angel. John Gill suggests another more natural, less supernatural means of death was that she was buried in a shower of fire and brimstone that was erupting from in the area. And I think that's the correct option. In my opinion, can't prove it, but that's what I think most probably happened to her. She got burnt up. Adam Clark says she might have gotten struck by lightning because that's also fire from heaven, but I don't think so in this case. So she's dead. She got struck dead, we're going to assume, by the fire and brimstone coming out of the ground and falling back to the ground. Another possible option, and this is just my speculation, is that she might have died from the shock of seeing what she had seen. It might have caused her to have a heart attack, and she could have died on the spot. Now, the next question we need to look at is was she turned into a pillar of salt? I'm going to give you three options. First option, she was at once turned into a metallic substance, a kind of salt, hard and durable. And she remained upright, standing on the ground. This is John Gill's suggestion. This is the way I took it as a child, and I always thought that was a little hard to imagine. I don't believe that Gill is right here. Here's what Adam Clark says, that she was enveloped in sulfur and asphalt as she fell to the ground. The sulfur and asphalt came out of the ground and got her, and she hits the ground, and the sulfur and asphalt rendered her corpse permanent, so her corpse did not decay, and it did need sulfur and asphalt not to decay in that desert environment. Corpses would have been permanent anyway. I saw a 1,000-year-old corpse in a place on the edge of the Taklamakan Desert in China. Kualoa was the name of the city. It was really remarkable. Not many people had seen this thing. The librarian let us in there, and there was a 1,000-year-old corpse looking at me. She was a little girl. Well, she might have been an adult. I don't know, but she was small. And she looked at me like she was a 20th century or 21st century human being. She was perfectly preserved, scorched and black from the heat of the sun, but the dry environment kept her preserved. And so that's the kind of environment that Lot's wife died in. So she would have been preserved, and then the salt would cover her body over time, and she would become a pillar of salt. And to me, that's my favorite explanation of it. Now, there's a variation on this theory that instead of asphalt and sulfur killing her, that hot thermal salt could have erupted from the ground and killed her. This is from Henry Morris, the famous creation geologist. He says this, quote, there are many great deposits of rock salt in the region, probably formed by massive precipitation from thermal brines upwelling from the earth's deep mantle during the Great Flood. Possibly the overthrow buried her in a shower of these salt deposits blown skyward by the explosions. There is also the possibility that she was buried in a shower of volcanic ash, with her body gradually being converted into salt over the years, following through the process of petrification in a manner similar to that experienced by the inhabitants of Pompeii and Herculaneum in the famous eruption of Mount Vesuvius. So when you really look at it, this is really not that hard to imagine Lot's wife turning into a pillar of salt, despite all my skeptical problems as a child. There's a third option, is that the pillar of salt was not physical but metaphorical. This is from Adam Clark. Pillars of salt were used as memorials when covenants were done. And so Clark says that Lot's wife has become a memorial, a pillar of salt, a memorial to sinners. You sin against what the angel tells you, boom, you die. Here's his quote. It is certain that salt is frequently used in the scriptures as an emblem of incorruption, durability, etc. Hence a covenant of salt, Numbers 18:19, is a perpetual covenant, one that is ever to be in full force and never broken. On this ground, a pillar of salt may signify no more in this case than an everlasting monument against criminal curiosity, unbelief, and disobedience. As an example of how that pillar of salt was metaphorical or was a memorial, you know, even if the pillar of salt was physical or non-physical, either way, it was a memorial Jesus referred to it in the Olivet Discourse as in a verse that people don't talk about too much, Luke 17, verses 31 and 32. Jesus speaking of the disasters that were going to occur pre-70 AD, he said, "On that day, the one who is on the housetop and whose goods are in the house must not go down to take them out, and likewise, the one who is in the field must not turn back. Remember Lot's wife." In other words, you better get out of Jerusalem when you get the chance, which is what they did, by the way. They fled to Pella. And Jesus is saying, don't waste time going back to get your goods, the cloak that's in the field that you left, or your goods in the house. Forget it. Get out of town. Remember Lot's wife. She took time to look back for her physical possessions, perhaps. But she looked back and she died. You're going to die too unless you get out of Jerusalem quick. The story there was the Roman general Gallus was half his name. I can't remember the other half. Cestus Gallus was his name. He had besieged the city that the people saw the abomination of desolation, which causes desolation surrounding the city, as Jesus warned them. They said, and he said, flee. And now in Luke 17, he says, and remember Lot's wife. Don't look back when you flee. And that's what happened. Cestus Gallus retreated. The zealots in the city who were locking the Christians in the city, they fled out of the city and chased Cestus Gallus north to Beth Horon, had a battle. And while they were having that battle at Beth Horon, the Christians got out of Dodge. They left Jerusalem, crossed the Jordan River at Pella, and were perfectly preserved. But if they had stayed and looked behind the Jerusalem like Lot's wife looked at Sodom, they would have died. And Jesus warned them and used Lot's wife as an example. So Lot's wife's very famous. Not in a good way. I guess she's infamous. We go now to verses 27, 28, and 29 of Genesis 19. Now Abraham arose early in the morning and went to the place where he had stood before the Lord. And he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah. Now that place is Hebron, which is roughly halfway up the western side of the Dead Sea. And if you look down from Hebron over the Dead Sea, you can see all the way down to the south end of the Dead Sea where Sodom and Gomorrah was. Verse 28, and he, Abraham, looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley. That's the Araba Valley there, which the Dead Sea was in the middle of. And he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of a furnace. Then it came about when God destroyed the cities of the valley that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot lived. Now God remembered Abraham because remember Abraham was praying in the previous chapter in verses 20 through 32 for Lot's deliverance. God, can you find 40 people down there? How about don't destroy the place? How about 35? Well, I think he started with 50, went down to 45, and then he went to 40, then he went to 30, then he went to 20, then he went to 10. And God said, if I can find 10. Well, he didn't find 10. But Abraham looks down there and he says, well, I guess my prayer wasn't answered. There goes Sodom's up in smoke and Gomorrah. So God didn't answer that prayer, but he did remember Abraham by saving Lot. God remembered Abraham. And recall that remember has two meanings. One is just to bring it back to your mind. And the other meaning is to do something good for somebody. For example, remember me in your will. We do the same thing in English as well as in the Hebrew there. And so God did something for Abraham. He delivered Lot. Abraham really cared about this nephew of his, despite the fact they had a little dispute over the grazing lands around Hebron when they split up their flocks and Lot went down to Sodom. And by the way, this is one more example of righteous people being saved in the midst of judgment. I know a lot of Americans are so concerned about judgment coming on America because of our filth, our moral corruption. And then, of course, a lot of this is fueled by unfortunate futurist panic porn prophecy, the Tim LaHaye nonsense that's out there. And that just leads to fear and trembling. And I really think if you want a point of application, okay, let's just say God does do all that stuff that Tim LaHaye says, which I don't believe for 1 minute, but let's say he does do that. Well, look what he did to Sodom and Gomorrah. That's pretty bad. And yet he delivered the righteous out of the mess. Now, of course, it wasn't pleasant for Lot, and it might not be pleasant for us as we try to survive in the midst of the judgment. But nonetheless, God preserves his people in the midst of judgment, just like he preserved the Israelites during the Exodus as the Egyptian army chased them, just like he preserved the Christians in Jerusalem, as I just related to you in the Jewish War, AD 66 through 70. Just like he preserved Noah and 8 righteous people when God flooded the whole world. God knows how to preserve his people in the midst of judgment, so let's don't worry about it. If God needs to judge, he's going to judge. And the good news about judgment, it wipes out sin, and that will be a marvelous event worth celebrating. When Abraham stood there in Hebron near the Oaks of Mamre, which is his place near Hebron, he saw that his prayer in the previous chapter had a negative answer. He had asked God to please, please, please spare Sodom because he was worried about Lot. You wonder, when he saw all that smoke, did he assume that Lot and his family were dead? He might not have found out till later that Lot had survived. So a lot of times, you know, you pray to God and things look so bad, and then all of a sudden you think, oh, God knew what he was doing all the time. He answered my prayer. I just didn't see how he answered it yet. Good sermon application point, or teaching application point there. Genesis 19:30, Lot went up from Zoar and stayed in the mountains, and his two daughters with him, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar, and he stayed in a cave, he and his two daughters. Remember, the angel had originally told Lot to go to the mountains where it would be safe from all the landslides, the uproars, and the upthrustings of the sulfur and the asphalt and all that stuff. In the mountains, you're going to be safe. And Lot says, I can't make it to the mountains. Let me go to Zoar. Well, verse 30, Lot leaves Zoar and goes to the mountains. In verses 19 through 21, this is the previous audio, chapter 19. This is what Lot said when the angel told him to go to the mountains. Your servant has indeed found favor with you, and you have shown me great kindness by saving my life. But I can't run to the mountains. The disaster will overtake me, and I will die. Look, this town is close enough for me to flee to. It is a small place. Zoar means small. Please let me run to it. It's only a small place, isn't it? So that I can survive. In other words, it's a small place. It probably is not going to be destroyed along with all the big places like Sodom and Gomorrah. It's off the radar scope. Let me go there. And he, the angel, said to him, to Lot, all right, I'll grant your request about this matter too, and will not demolish the town you mentioned. So Lot apparently goes to Zoar, and then in verse 30 of Genesis 19, he leaves Zoar. He went up from Zoar and stayed in the mountains. Went up because he has to go to the mountains, which is up. What made Lot change his mind about staying in Zoar? Well, Zoar was near to Sodom. If you look at the map, it's right at the southern tip of the Dead Sea, right next to the Zered Brook, which is sort of a big wadi there, a big brook that runs into the southern part of the Dead Sea, coming from Edom or Moab. I'm not sure. I think that's on the border of Edom and Moab. But anyway, the Zered Brook runs right past Zoar, and it doesn't have a question mark on my map, so I assume they know where it is there. But it's pretty close to the Salt Sea, and it's pretty close to Sodom. We know it's fairly close to Sodom, and so the fiery destruction of Sodom might have unnerved Lot and said, well, you know, Sodom went down, Zoar might be next. Maybe I need to get out of here. Maybe that angel was right. Maybe I need to go to the mountains. And also, you might have had the situation where waters from the Salt Sea may have been rising. So Lot might have been scared Zoar would be flooded, inundated. So you can make the argument that Lot was wrong in the first place not to go to the mountain. Well, the angel told him to go to start with. However, the angel had assured Lot that Zoar was safe, so if he believed the angel, he would have stayed in Zoar. He should have listened to the angel. In the first case or the second case, either way, he should have listened to the angel, but he was intent on not listening to the angel. Adam Clark said it was wrong of Lot to leave Zoar. He should have stayed there. If he'd stayed in Zoar, he probably wouldn't have committed incest, which we're about to read about. We go now to Genesis 19, verses 31 and 32. Then the firstborn, that's the firstborn of Lot, the older daughter, said to the younger daughter, our father is old, and there is not a man on earth to come into us after the manner of the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and let us lie with him, that we may preserve our family through our father. Now, this is going to be a disgusting story here. It's excited a lot of comment. I remember the first time I read it, I could hardly believe it. Well, let's look at it through the viewpoint of the daughters. First of all, their father is old. Why would they say their father is old? Probably that means because he's not going to have any more kids, or he's not going to be able to provide us with a husband, especially holed up in a cave in the mountains in the middle of a destroyed, a post-apocalyptic world. And so our father's not going to help us find us a husband. And so the girls resort to expediency, incest. Now, let's try to put as good a spin on this from the girls' point of view. Here's what John Gill says. The daughters may have thought the whole world had been destroyed, especially as they were holed up in their cave and everything else around them is fire and brimstone, a smoking ruin. So they may have thought that incest was the only way to save the human race. They might have been the last people on earth that were fertile. John Gill says that even though that's so, that doesn't excuse incest. It could have been the daughters were thinking, well, there might be people around, but there are no decent people around, just a bunch of sodomites. After all, they had just been marked for destruction by God, so how can we expect to find decent husbands in the midst of all this? So that excuses the incest. Well, I'm going to, at the end of this discussion of these two verses, I'm going to discuss what I think about what Lot's daughters did, but let's just leave it right there. They were in a bad situation. Let's give that to them. Now, they were worried about preserving their family. That was a big deal back there in the ancient world and underpopulated world. Just survival was necessary. An increase in population was very, very important, especially when they had infant mortality, I'm assuming. So they wanted to preserve their family. But John Gill says it may not have just been their family they wanted to preserve. They might have been looking for the Messiah, because back there was a dim memory, at least, of the Messiah, the descendant of Eve, who was going to strike the devil in the head when the devil was going to wound the Messiah in the heel, as we know from Genesis 3. I think it's verse 15, the Proto-Evangelion. Well, that idea might have been passed all the way down from Adam and Eve all the way down to Lot's daughters. They might have been looking for the Messiah. They say, oh, we got to get the Messiah. We can't let the Messiah not arrive. Now, again, this is just another example of using the flesh to accomplish God's purposes, just like Abraham did with Hagar. Now, let me read Clark as he tries to make Lot's daughters not look so bad. Quote, excuse me, this is Gill first. Quote, when we remark their former chaste life in Sodom, they're joining together in this contrivance, which had it been a lustful business, they would have been ashamed to have communicated their thoughts of it to one another. So obviously the girls weren't lusting. They weren't horny. I mean, that's ridiculous. And so Gill points that out. And their imposition of names on their children to perpetuate the memory of this fact. Moab means of the father, from the waters of the father, from the sperm of the father. I mean, it just, hey, they didn't try to hide what they were doing. They rather gloried in it, Gill continues, than were ashamed of. To which may be added that the ancient Jewish writers interpret this of the Messiah, and they observe, it is not said a son, but seed, that seed which is he that comes from another place. And what is this? This is the King Messiah. I don't know what that means. They thought that their seed was the Messiah, according to the rabbis. And Ruth the Moabitess, who was of the race of the eldest daughter of Lot, stands in the genealogy of our Lord. However, let the intention be ever so good, it will not justify an action so monstrously vile. Well, I agree, it's monstrously vile, it's disgusting, but they were trying, they had good motives. They weren't just lusting after their father, they were trying to preserve their family. All right, we'll give them that. Now, here's what Clark says about it. Quote, after considering all that has been said to criminate both Lot and his daughters in this business, and I'm going to criminate them in this business in just a minute, Clark continues, I cannot help thinking that the transaction itself will bear a more favorable construction than that which has been generally put on it. One, it does not appear that it was through any base or sensual desires that the daughters of Lot wished to deceive their father. Well, we've already given them that. Number two, they might have thought that it would have been criminal to have married into any other families. They knew that their husbands elect, who were probably of the same kindred, had perished in the overthrow of Sodom. All right, we'll give them that. They didn't have any husbands anymore, any decent husbands, although they were engaged to people of Sodom. You wonder how decent they were. But anyway, they didn't have any prospects. Number three, Clark continues, they might have supposed that there was no other way left to preserve the family, and consequently that righteousness for which it had been remarkable, but the way which they now took. In other words, no choice but incest, because we don't have a family. Number four, they appear to have supposed that their father would not come into the measure because he would have considered it as profane. Well, I would think so. Yet, judging the measure to be expedient and necessary, they endeavored to sanctify the improper means used by the goodness of the end at which they aimed. Well, that's what Adam Clark says. And he goes on further to say if they had base motives, they just wanted to have sex, they would have repeated the incest when they didn't do that. Well, folks, that doesn't really justify them. This is basically the ends justify the means argument, according to Adam Clark. I don't think that's going to fly. Now, it's ironic that Lot had exposed his two daughters to rape. You remember when he had offered the men of Sodom, the homosexuals who were trying to crash into his house, to rape the angels that Lot was putting up. And Gil and Lot said, look, guys, I'll give you my two virgin daughters. Just leave these two men alone. So Lot had exposed his two daughters to rape, and now he's quasi-raped by his own daughters. Kind of ironic, is it not? This is righteous Lot doing this. Righteous Lot. Again, let me just say this in 2 Peter. Peter, and I forgot the verse, but three times he calls Lot righteous. This righteous man suffering by what he had seen. Well, it means righteous in the sense that he believed God. It doesn't mean that he lived a life of moral impeccable purity. No, that's not what righteous Lot means. Here's what John Gill says about Lot. Quote, he that had stood his ground in the midst of Sodom, notwithstanding all the excesses of that place, the impurities in it, and the temptations that every day offered, now falls when seemingly out of the way of all. He withstood the temptations of Sodom, gets off on a mountain in a cave by himself, and then commits incest. So, in the end, Lot really didn't escape his ensnarement of the world, did he? So maybe those people who say that he came down and was in the gate of Sodom, and therefore he was in the government of Sodom, and therefore he had, and he married his daughters off to the people of Sodom. Maybe he had just totally succumbed to the allurements of the world. We go now to Genesis 19, verses 33 through 35. So they, that's the two daughters, made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father. And he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. On the following day, the firstborn said to the younger, "Behold, I lay last night with my father. Let us make him drink wine tonight also, then you go in and lie with him, that we may preserve our family through our father." Now think about this. Noah is an old man, as the daughters have pointed out, an old man, and he's drunk. And he's having sex twice, two nights in a row, not even knowing what's going on. Man, Noah must have been a man. They didn't have Viagra and Cialis back then. Verse 35, so they made their father drink wine that night also, and the younger arose and lay with him, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. Now, the fact that Lot was drunk means that he did not mean to commit incest. I'm sure the daughters knew he wasn't going to do that. However, his drinking culpably led to the incest. He bore responsibility for that drinking and what follows from the drinking. It's just like in the law today, you get drunk and you don't mean to hit somebody in your car. You're still guilty of manslaughter because you are responsible for the after effects of your drinking. Lot was guilty because of that. He shouldn't have gotten drunk. Now, why was he drinking? He might have been prone to drink because he had lost his goods and his wife, and he's living in his cave, and possibly two other daughters, depending on whether Lot had two or four daughters. That's ambiguous. But he at least lost his house and his every wealthy thing he had, all of his flocks. Everything's gone. His wife is gone. He might have been drinking to try to ease the pain. He didn't mean to commit incest, but he did mean to. Well, he might not have meant to get drunk either, but he drank to excess and got drunk, and there's no excuse for it. Now, it says that Lot did not know when his older daughter got up or lay down, and likewise didn't know when the younger daughter got up, went, laid down, and got up. He just didn't know what was going on. Now, John lists some options to how we can view this. John Gill says Lot never knew anything at all about what had happened, and I think that's probably what happened. He was so drunk, he was drunk out of his mind, didn't know what happened. It could be, however, another option is he knew he had sex with somebody, but he didn't know the women he had sex with were his daughters. Here's what John Gill says, quote, "He was so dead drunk and fast asleep was he, but finding a woman in bed with him, lay with her, taking her to be his wife, forgetting through the force of liquor that she was dead." Well, that's an interesting idea. Adam Clark may have thought it was female slaves brought from Zoar. Here's what Clark says, quote, "In this transaction, Lot appears to me to be in many respects excusable. Number one, he had no accurate knowledge of what took place either on the first or second night, therefore he cannot be supposed to have been drawn away by his own lust and enticed. That he must have been sensible that some person had been in his bed, it would be ridiculous to deny, but he might, well, I don't know why that's ridiculous. He could have been so drunk he might not have known it. But he might have judged it to have been some of his female domestics, which it is reasonable to suppose he might have brought from Zoar. Number two, it is very likely that he was deceived in the wine as well as in the consequences. Either he knew not the strength of the wine, or wine of a superior power had been given to him on this occasion. As he had in general followed the simple pastoral life, it is not to be wondered at if he did not know the intoxicating power of wine." That's not going to fly, Mr. Clark. It's not going to fly. As John Gill points out, if the daughters knew that the wine would get him drunk, why in the world wouldn't Lot know? Is Lot more naive than his own daughters? Lot must have known how strong the wine was. You're not going to get him off on that, being ignorant of the strength of the wine. "Being an old man," Clark continues, "and unused to it, unused to the wine, a small portion would be sufficient to overcome him. Sound sleep would soon, at his time of life, be the effect of taking the liquor to which he was unaccustomed and cause him to forget the effects of his intoxication. Except in this case, his moral conduct stands unblemished in the sacred writings." What Clark is doing here is, because Peter calls them righteous Lot, he's trying to make him look righteous. No, folks, he wasn't righteous. This is nonsense, in my humble opinion. I know Clark is a polymath, a lot smarter than I am, but I'm telling you, this does not fly. Lot must have known that that wine would get him drunk. He must have known how strong it was, and he must have known that he was drinking to excess. And that's what happens when you drink to excess. Bad things happen. Clark finishes with his encomium on Lot's righteousness. He says, "The whole transaction, especially as it relates to him, is capable of an interpretation not wholly injurious to his piety. Both reason and religion conjoin to recommend that explanation." Clark would have been a good lawyer. O.J. Simpson could have hired him to defend his murder trial. Now, in verse 35, we read this, "So they made, the daughters made their father drink wine that night also." Now, that might seemed to take some of the blame away from Lot, made, well, it's really like caused him to drink wine that night. They didn't force Noah to drink the wine. They just served it to him, and Noah says, ooh, wine, I'll drink it. So you know, Lot's not going to get off. The daughters couldn't have forced him to drink the wine. They were women. And besides, that's just absurd to say that the daughters forced Lot to drink wine. Lot drank that wine on his own accord. Lot didn't have to drink the wine to start with. All right, so let's look at all the blame that's to go around in this unfortunate story. We've already seen that Lot was guilty from drinking, if not from the incest. But the daughters were definitely guilty, despite the very difficult situation they were in. Now let's think about what would have happened if the daughters had not committed this horrible moral crime, if they'd have just toughed it out. Well, they might have died as spinsters, but what's worse, to be a spinster or to die knowing that you committed incest? They could have been spinsters. Things settled down in the South as the smoke dissipated from the destruction, and the Lot could have migrated back to Hebron with Abraham, his relative, his uncle. Abraham would probably have taken them in. Now, when they got to Hebron, they would not have had Hebrew husbands yet, because Abraham's family had not grown yet. Isaac had not been born yet. But still, they would not have been committed incest. They would have still been sexually pure. And they might have been gotten married to Canaanite husbands. Well, how's that any worse than the two deceased Sodomite fiancés that they had? I don't see how that's any worse. And as a result of the incest, they spawned two of Israel's most inveterate enemies, Moab and Ammon, that Israel was constantly fighting against. So the daughters were guilty of incest. They were brazen about it. They even named their kids, so one of the kids especially, Moab, of the father, or of the waters of the father, or the sperm of the father, named their kids so that everybody would know that the kids were born of incest, and they didn't seem ashamed of it. I don't think there's any excuse for what they did. Genesis 19, verses 36 through 38, and we will finish up this section. Thus both the daughters of Lot were with child by their father. The firstborn bore a son, that means the oldest daughter, bore a son and called his name Moab. He is the father of the Moabites to this day. As for the younger, she also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the sons of Ammon to this day. All right, Moab and Ammon, if you'll look at a map, which is what I'm doing now, Moab starts with the river Arnon in the north. This is on the east side of the Dead Sea. River Arnon runs in the Dead Sea directly across the mouth of the Arnon. There is En-Gedi, the famous palm place, oasis there. That's about halfway down the Dead Sea, and you go further south to the brook Zered, which I've already mentioned. It runs by Zoar. That's the border of Edom. So Moab goes from the Arnon River to the Zered River, the southeastern shore and beyond of the Dead Sea. That's Moab. And then if you go back to the Arnon River, which is in the middle of the Dead Sea, cross from En-Gedi, and go north past the northern end of the Dead Sea all the way up, part of the way up the Jordan River Valley, up to the Jabbok River, that's Ammon. And at the northern end of Ammon is Rabbath Ammon, the famous ancient city, which today is Ammon, Jordan. And you notice the similarity of the names, Ammon and Ammon. All right, so that's where Moab and Ammon came from, was incest with Lot. As I said earlier, the descendants of Moab and Ammon became bitter, idolatrous enemies of the Jews, 1 Samuel 14:47, and this is just an example. Now, when Saul had taken the kingdom over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, the sons of Ammon, Edom, the sons, kings of Zobah, and the Philistines. So he fought against Moab. In 2 Chronicles 21, we see this. That was Saul fighting against Moab. 2 Chronicles 20. Verse 1, now it came about after this that the sons of Moab and the sons of Ammon, came to make war against Jehoshaphat. He was the king of Judah. So, constant warfare. Thank you, daughters of Lot, because you got to have a kid. You got to commit sexual immorality to get the kid. Now, these battles with Moab and Ammon is another example of the sons of the flesh at wars with the sons of the spirit, my terminology. The sons of the spirit, of course, would be the children of the promised seed, the covenant children of Israel fighting the sons of the flesh who came from incest, Moab and Ammon. We have other examples of that in the Old Testament. Ishmael, sons of the flesh, Hagar versus Isaac, son of Sarah, son of the promise. Esau versus Jacob. Esau sold his birthright for a mess of pottage, a stew, fighting against Jacob, who was given the inheritance, the birthright through Abraham, sons of the flesh versus sons of the spirit. And then, of course, Cain and Abel. Abel being the righteous Abel, son of the spirit, versus Cain, the son of the flesh. This is a theme that you see all the way through the Old Testament. Here's what Adam Clark says about the Moabites and the Ammonites. Quote, "The Moabites soon fell from the faith of God and became idolaters, the people of Chemosh, that was their god, and of Baal Peor, another god, and were enemies to the children of Abraham," quoting a bunch of places in Numbers. "And the Ammonites, who dwelt near to the Moabites, just to their north, united with them in idolatry. The Ammonites united with the Moabites in idolatry and were also enemies to Israel." Lots of quotes in Judges and Deuteronomy. Now, the name Moab means from the father, as John Gill says. There's some other possible translations. Clark translates it this way, of the father. In other words, my son came from my father. Clark says it can be translated this way, the waters of the father, referring to Lot's sperm. My son is called waters of my father's sperm, or sperm of my father. That's what my son is named. Oh, my gosh. Well, I don't know how accurately those translations are, but basically the idea means it is very obvious. Very obvious what the older daughter saying is, my son came from sex with my father. Didn't make any bones about it. As John Gill says, the mother certainly wasn't ashamed of what she had done. Now, the sons of Moab were called that till this day. That's because Moses is writing the book. He wrote about, 14, 50, 40, 30, somewhere in there. And Abraham, he came into Hebron when he was 75 years old. That was 1875 or so. And then he been another 13 years before this incident happened. So we're talking about 1860 or so B.C. So we're talking about 400 years or so. That's just a good round number to remember. The distance between Abraham and Moses is 400 years, roughly. More precisely, is 430, but just say 400 years. I've already gone through all the math of that in earlier chapters of Genesis and previous audios. So to this day, they're called Moab. Now, the younger daughter had a son. His name was Ben-Ami, which means son of my people, because Lot was the father, so he's the son of my people being my father. Now, that name is not quite as blatant as the other daughter's name, but still there's a trace of acknowledgement of the incest, as John Gill says. So we take our farewell of Lot. This is the last time we ever hear of him. This was the inglorious end of a righteous man who compromised with his culture. There's no known city or town containing his name. However, he is called righteous by Peter in the New Testament, 2 Peter 2:7. And if he recognized righteous Lot, and if he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men. So Lot was a mixed bag. We're finished now with Genesis 19. In our next audio, we're going to start in Genesis 20. We're going to do not only start, but finish the whole chapter of Genesis 20, verses 1 through 18. The story of Abraham and Abimelech of Gerar, which is a little tiny kingdom to the south of Gaza, between Egypt and Israel, where Abraham once again managed to get Sarah put into a harem. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.